Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host today is Dave Allen, as we bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. It's Friday, October 30th, 2020. Good afternoon, Dave.
TGIF,
I think you're there.
Hello,
are you there, Dave?
TGIF.
All righty. I didn't hear you. Just to let the listeners know, I'm having a little computer issue, so I'm doing my first segment today by telephone, and then David will take over the second and third segment today. So I think we have a little bit of a delay there because of this. So it's one segment, so stay tuned, and lots of things happening today. Gold today is up, right now in the New York spot price aftermarket, $990, $10, $1,878 off the high of $1,891. Silver is up 39 cents at $23.71. Platinum was down a dollar at $850, and palladium was up $23 at $2,245. USDX today is stronger by 0.08 at 94.01. It got over that 94 level. Crude oil is down 63 cents at $35.54. The Dow, I'm going to just let a couple of numbers come through again. Let's see. You know, all I do know is the stocks are on track to wrap up their worst week since March. I mean, we were down 400 points earlier in the day on the Dow. Right now it's looking at about 155 points to the downside, 26,503. The NASDAQ was down 2.5% at 10,911. The S&P was down 40 points at 3,270. The 10-year yield is 0.86%. That really moved. And, you know, the European and Asian markets were all negative. Hong Kong was down 2%. Japan was down 1.5%. London, Germany, they were negative, but just barely. And I don't know if this is... No, that's something different. That's May 15th. Okay, so, you know, the stocks were on track, Dave, to wrap up their worst week since March, and it has been very volatile, and I don't know if there's anything you'd like to add to that. Again, we were down, 485 points on the Dow early this afternoon, and there's just a lot of volatility, and you can point it to various things, but, you know, no stimulus, some stimulus, who's being elected. Any comments?
Well, and the worsening pandemic, at least in 41 of the 50 states. And, you know, that's giving rise to what Brian Belsky of BMO Capital Markets calls the three-headed monster. Hear him roar. And, yeah, it's likely to be this way up until next Tuesday. When voters who haven't voted early go to the polls across the country. And at the same time, you know, these infections in the U.S. and Europe are competing for investors' attentions. So, you know, as we mentioned on Wednesday's program, you and I, Melody, the VIX Volatility Index touched the highest level since June. Though it's still nowhere near the crazy levels was seen that we saw back in March,
right.
The last time the paper markets went crazy.
Well, you know, there was a U.N., you know, we've been talking about the stimulus and so forth, and now it looks like McConnell said, let me see if I can pull this up here, that it's going to be any new coronavirus aid package should be considered in early 2021.
Yeah.
Possibly closing the door to any legislation, you know, following the November 3rd elections. So they're waiting at the beginning of the year, so nothing is going to get done. I mean, you know, the third quarter wasn't bad, and I think they're waiting to see what the fourth quarter is going to do before they add any more stimulus. I mean, why would they add stimulus if they're getting, you know, getting the numbers that they want to get?
Yeah, that's a good
point. Doesn't matter that people can't pay their rent, and doesn't matter that.
Yeah.
You know, all of that's eventually going to hit home, but, you know, until it does, I don't think they're going to do anything. You know, stimulus is on hold, but we'll wait and see. Who knows? Who knows what D.C. is going to do at any given time?
Indeed. I mean, the thing that strikes me is that we really won't have a good feel for fourth quarter numbers until after January 20th, the inauguration of the president. So, I mean, there certainly will be inklings by then. I'm sure the New York and Atlanta Fed will be out with their preliminaries, as will virtually every other Wall Street bank. So we might have some kind of consensus earlier in the month. I just don't see well, it'll be interesting. I mean, if Mnuchin and Pelosi, you know, work over the holidays while all the members are back in their home districts with their families and constituents, perhaps they strike a deal and work on language so that when the new Congress convenes in early January, it could be taken up. But of course, the outcome of the presidential election will could likely drive how that is going to go and what levels of support either of the candidates might go for. So, yeah, the uncertainty continues for sure.
One day at a time.
Hey.
At a time, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, it just really is crazy. So many things that are coming out, and the articles and the information. It's just you know, it is kind of frightening. But to see what we're facing here in the short term. But in the meantime, we're going to talk about the Chicago PMI that fell in October. Fell to 61.1 in October from 62 in September. Nevertheless, I mean, it was still in expansion territory. It was above 50. The Chicago PMI, also known as Chicago Business Barometer, it's similar to the national ISM manufacturing indicator, but only at a regional level. And to some, it's seen by many, or seen by some, as an indicator of the larger U.S. economy. It's a composite diffusion indicator. It's made up of production, new orders, order backlogs, employment, supplier deliveries that are compiled through surveys. Here's an excerpt from the press release. October marks the fourth consecutive reading for the Chicago. If I can read it, October marks the fourth consecutive reading for the Chicago barometer above the 50 mark after sitting below it for a year. So, among the main five indicators, new orders was the only category to show a monthly uptick, while production recorded the largest decline.
Yeah, and before July of this year, the index was below the 50 mark for 11 of the previous 12 months, signaling a decline in production activity dating back to the summer of 2019, well before the pandemic came to town, and confirming, in this respect anyway, what you've been saying for since the beginning of the year, or at least since April, when the federal government officially declared February as the start of the, quote, pandemic-related or induced recession, that things had been not looking all that good in various parts of the economy well before then. So now, during the Great Recession, this index was stuck below 50 for 18 months before it broke back into expansion territory on its way to a 20-year high of 70 in early 2011. It was also below the 50 level for an 8-month period in 2015 and 16. So here we are again, Melody. The roller coaster ride continues.
It is. And of course, I've heard that we've passed the corner, that we are now an official V-shape recovery. Yes, how about that? It was announced. Yeah, we are. It's official. V-shape recovery.
I didn't expect to be hearing that from you today.
Well, that's what, you know, comes from government, but
okay.
But anyway, not from me, but from the government. But I think this is some good news. But I'm not, reading through this article about the U.S. crop harvest is really advancing at the fastest pace in years, and that's replenishing coffers for shippers at a time when few other countries are competing with the U.S. for export demand. You have, you know, importers such as China and Mexico, they've been gobbling up large amounts of U.S. agricultural goods. The deals, coupled with adverse weather in Russia and South America, have boosted prices during the harvest period that typically sees some of the lowest values of the year. So while sales are still lagging the pace, of course, needed to meet China's trade deal commitment to buy $36.5 billion in U.S. goods this year, buyers in China have bought record amounts in recent months. Buyers in Brazil, which typically competes with the U.S. for international business, well, they're purchasing from the U.S. due to short domestic supplies. I mean, it's a positive turn of event for American farmers, you know, who saw a hit to exports in 2018 because of the trade war. And then in 2019, they were pummeled by rains that delayed plantings and then the harvest. And you know what, Dave? It's hard to believe that it was been this long that we've been talking about those rains and the delayed plantings. I mean, it seems like it was yesterday. It just goes by so fast. Yeah. But the American corn harvest was 72% complete as of October 25th, above the year-ago pace of 38%, and the quickest in 5 years for the country's most widely grown crop. And this is all according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. You know, soybeans, the second biggest crop, were 83% harvested versus 57% a year ago. So, I mean, it really is, it is good news, but my question is, can our farmers keep up with exporting what happens to our supplies?
Well, presumably, the domestic supplies are getting to where they have to, by and large. Now, we still read of shortages in grocery store, not to the extent as we were seeing and reading about back in the spring and over the summer, with some of the supply chains, you know, sort of slowly coming back together. But the question is there going to be the worldwide demand for all of this, particularly as some countries, although we do know the major producers of the world's grains other than the U.S., are fairly self-sufficient. So that tells me it's not going to be a huge issue But again, you know, with some ongoing issues with tariffs, you know, the price supports for U.S. farmers will continue to be an issue, Melody.
Well, everything is all good as long as it stays the same. But what happens if we go into something different and all of a sudden people are beginning to remember the shortages from earlier this year, and now they're going to the store and they're beginning to stock up, they're beginning to hoard a little bit more, and you know, I think we're going to see increases in shortages here soon if it continues. So,
Melody,
you know, I don't.
Oh no, I was just going to say Merry Christmas in advance. The half dozen of big boxes you get in the mail, delivered by your friendly neighborhood delivery person, will be your Christmas present from us this year. 6 months worth of toilet paper and paper towels.
I'll take it.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Merry Christmas to you too. I don't buy this report at all. It just doesn't seem to make sense, and I don't know where they reported that Americans' incomes increased in September by more than expected. And whenever they add more than expected, you know they rig the numbers. Yeah. Boosted by employment gains. I mean, we've talked day in and day out of the number of jobs that are being lost and people laid off and they can't find employment. There are jobs out there, but nobody takes them. But they're saying boosted by employment gains and helping to propel consumer spending. At the end of the third quarter, personal incomes rose 0.9% from the prior month, following a 2.5% decline in August. That compared with estimates for a 0.4% gain. Household outlays advanced 1.4%, also exceeded forecasts. Now, the figures add color to yesterday's report on GDP, which showed personal spending rose by an annualized 41% in the quarter, by far the most on record. I didn't think it was 41%. I thought it was still in the...
Well, it was the overall GDP was in the 30s, 33, but
right.
Personal spending...
This is personal spending. The economy
31.
Has surpassed many over the past months, thanks in part to a resilient consumer, and hundreds of thousands more Americans have headed back to work in September. I guess that would be teachers, because schools opened and so forth.
Yeah, I didn't look at last month's breakdown, but that does make sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Just a little bit, but I still question, because a lot more were laid off. Anyway, we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it: to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSC Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSC Talk CommonSenseTalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hey, welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen, sitting in for Melody these last two segments, who, because of some unfortunate technology issues, is going to leave her in the office attending to some customer business before the weekend kicks in full stream. Now, before we headed into the break, Melly was talking about the government's latest personal income and spending reports, just to bring that to some closure. As we know from yesterday's reports, GDP rose by a record 33% in the third quarter, and the better-than-expected September spending figures released by the government, dubious as they are, suggest the economy headed into the final 3 months of the year with some positive momentum. However, you know, at the same time, the pace of consumer spending has been slowing down significantly, and that's at best. It's been falling at worst. More on that in today's third segment. The personal saving rate also fell for a fifth month in September, but still remained elevated at a little over 14% compared to February's rate of about 8.3. Now, you know, it looks like the Federal Reserve has gotten tired of waiting for Congress and the White House to strike a deal for more stimulus. And so today, the Fed announced that it has lowered the barriers on its lending program for smaller businesses as part of an effort to broaden the appeal of this smartly used program. In another pair of tweaks to its Main Street Lending, it calls it a facility, I like the word program, the Fed said it's reducing the minimum loan size from $250,000 to $100,000. It's also going to ease restrictions on debt for companies already participating in the Paycheck Protection Program. Now, aimed at helping small and medium-sized businesses get through the pandemic, the program thus far has issued about 400 loans totaling $3.7 billion. That's a mere 0.6%, however, of the total capacity of the program, which is $600 billion. Thanks to $7,500 billion in collateral from the Treasury Department that can be leveraged under law up to 8 times that collateral amount. The Fed said the changes are two important ways to better target support to small businesses and are facing continued revenue shortfalls due to the pandemic. Now, of course, Main Street program is part of a raft of programs the Fed rolled out shortly following the pandemic's escalation back in March. So, listen, it's time for our weekly segment, Levity is Golden. Today's topic, well, let's just say, woof, woof. Yes, dogs. People like you and me, well, at least people like Melody and me, know that dogs are humans' best friends, and vice versa. And a new study of dog DNA shows that our best friend in the animal world may also be our oldest one. The analysis reveals that dog domestication can be traced back 11,000 years to the end of the last ice age. And that confirms that dogs were domesticated before any other known animal species. Our canine companions were widespread across the Northern Hemisphere at this time and had already split into 5 different types. And despite the expansion of European dogs during the colonial era, traces of these ancient indigenous breeds survive today, at least in the Americas, in Asia, Africa, and Oceania. Dr. Pontus Skoglund, co-author of the study, says dogs are really unique in being this quite strange thing if you think about it. When all peoples were still hunter-gatherers, they domesticate what is really a wild carnivore. Are pretty frightening in many parts of the world, you know. And he added, the question of why did people do that? How did that come about? That's what we're ultimately interested in. Now, to a large extent, or at least some, dog genetic patterns mirror human ones. That's because people took their animal companions with them when they moved. But there were also important differences. For example, early European dogs were initially diverse, appearing to originate from two distinct populations, one related to Near Eastern dogs and another to Siberian dogs. But at some point, they say, perhaps after the onset of the Bronze Age, a single dog lineage spread widely and replaced all other dog populations on the continent. And this pattern has no counterpart in the genetic patterns of people from Europe. Gregor Larson, who's a co-author of the studies from the University of Oxford, said, using DNA from ancient dogs is showing us just how far back our shared history goes and will ultimately help us understand when and where this deep relationship began. Dogs are thought to have evolved from wolves that ventured into human camps, perhaps sniffing around for food. And then as they were tamed, they could then have served humans as hunting companions or even guards. The results suggest all dogs derive from a single extinct wolf population, or perhaps a very few closely related ones. If there were multiple domestication events around the world, these other lineages didn't contribute much DNA to later dogs. Now, many animals, such as cats, probably became our pets when humans settled down to farm a little over 6,000 years ago. Cats were probably useful for controlling pests such as mice that were attracted by the waste generated by these dense settlements. And that places their domestication in cradles of agriculture, such as the Near East. For dogs, it could have been almost anywhere. Cold Siberia, the warm Near East, Southeast Asia, all of them are actually possibilities. Regardless of where they came from, dogs today are everywhere, on every continent, and in virtually every town around the world. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is this week's Levity is Golden. Have you hugged a dog today? Now, with enrollment numbers plunging, some colleges and universities are taking an aggressive approach to lure students back. One school's even slashing its price, totally, for first-year students. Amid the pandemic, financial constraints have finally put a limit on what families can or are willing to pay. Many also contend that remote learning just isn't worth the same as face-to-face instruction, and that's causing some would-be college students to rethink their plans altogether. As campuses shut down due to the pandemic, a growing list of universities, including well-known names, Princeton, Georgetown, Johns Hopkins, to name a few, have offered a 10% discount on tuition for students studying remotely to account for changes in their experience. Williams College in Massachusetts and Hampton University in Virginia reduced their tuition and fees by 15% for the current academic year. And Paul Quinn College, a small private college in Dallas, slashed the cost of attendance there even further by 28% after deciding to fully remain online this fall. For years, we know college costs have crept higher and higher, exceeding the general rate of inflation and creating an affordability crisis for students and their families. The Great Recession led to declining funds from state and local governments, forcing many colleges to rely on tuition as a primary source of revenue. And as a result, the cost of attendance is steadily ticked up, rising 3 to 5% every year, outpacing reported government inflation as well as family income. And now, in the middle of this pandemic, schools are under more pressure to keep those increases in check. Overall, average tuition and fees has increased just 1.1% for in-state students at four-year public colleges and 2.1% for students at four-year private institutions this academic year. That's the lowest percentage increases in three decades. And already, a number of institutions have announced that they're freezing tuition next year in hopes of attracting more students and families, particularly those struggling with the weight of a higher education tab during this ongoing economic crisis. And that could just be, that could be just the start. Beginning next fall, Rider University said it will reduce its undergraduate tuition for new students by 22% to $35,000, down from $45,000. Farley Dickinson University, also in New Jersey, announced it will slash tuition for all new students to $32,000. That's beginning next fall. That's a 22 to 25% discount. And here we go. In what's being called a stunning move, Southern New Hampshire University said it's offering a free year for first-time freshmen on campus this fall and discounting tuition by more than 60% next year as well. Move over, Bernie Sanders. You've got nothing on New Hampshire. After that announcement, by the way, New Hampshire, enrollments there spiked 45%. Compared to last year. Moving overseas for a minute, Bill Morneau, the former Canadian finance minister, is saying that one of his first priority, if he should become head of the OECD, will be to work towards a solution for a cross-border digital tax. That's presumably with the U.S. Morneau, who is in the running to become Secretary General of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, said agreement on a cross-border tax for the digital economy was a real issue that needs to be resolved. Today, he said, I think the way that we get to a conclusion is to recognize that for the digital giants, it's better for them to understand what their situation is. They need to understand what their tax situation is in different countries, so they have a vested interest in getting to a conclusion. Morneau's comments come amid ongoing tensions between the U.S. and various European countries over the taxation of tech companies like Apple, Alphabet, and Amazon. Now, earlier this month, the OECD warned that countries risk damaging the global economy if they didn't reach an agreement. Its current head, Angel Gurria, said that he hoped the final details would be settled by mid-year 2021. In the remaining time, the rest of this segment, let's talk about gold. Two articles that caught our attention today, explain where things are with gold and silver right now, where they're headed at least over the short term. As we know, gold hit a one-month low this week amid election uncertainty and renewed pandemic fears, among other factors. But the million-dollar question is, at least according to commodities broker Bob Habercorn, is when will the metals start acting like metals again? Gold tumbled to a low of $1,859 yesterday and was unable to recover significantly higher today, and particularly to get back over $1,900. Habercorn said, we have the infections uptick, stocks are down, the dollar's up. The markets were anticipating a stimulus deal, but there's no stimulus coming between now and the election. In fact, as Melody mentioned in the first segment, it looks as though nothing coming until at least sometime in January. Now, he added, if the paper market sell-off gets worse right before the election, gold will first test $1,850 an ounce and then $1,825. He said, we really could see $1,825 again if you get more announcements of shutdowns because of COVID. Equities could get spooked even more, which will probably in turn put gold and silver lower ahead of the election. But he said, if you asked me 2 weeks ago who was going to win, I would have told you Biden. If you asked me today, I'm starting to think Trump's going to pull this thing out based on recent data that's been coming out. He added, you could see a Trump win, which would be a significant rally in the equities that night, and then a significant rise in gold and silver, along with equities, coupled with the hope that a stimulus deal would be coming through. If Biden wins, he adds, the metals, including gold, probably will rally perhaps even more, because the Biden stimulus package would likely be significantly higher than Trump's. Either way, after we get past the election next week, you should see a rally in the precious metals, because the likelihood of a stimulus deal coming through will be that much more. What investors need come next week, he says, is for gold to start acting like gold by providing safety. Right now, even though everything feels risk-off, most of the safe haven bids are directed at the U.S. dollar. He said, metals need to start acting like metals here. They're so tied with equities, and it's been going on since the pandemic hit. When equities go down, metals go down. When equities go up, metals go up. Problem right now is that the same reason why metals go up is why stocks are going up. Government stimulus and printing money. So that's the million-dollar question. When do metals start acting like metals again? Well, Habercorn answered it by saying gold's decoupling from equities might come as soon as the markets get through the election, which, by the way, would mean at some point next week or the week after. Just a couple seconds till we head into the break. I'll just say briefly, central banks shifted to being net sellers for the first time in nearly a decade, sellers of gold, that is, with net sales estimated just under 13 tons for the third quarter. That's according to research from the firm Refinitiv. Shift was driven by an absence of purchases, particularly from Russia and China. You hear the music, ladies and gentlemen. That means you're going to hear some important messages, so please stay tuned, and we'll be back right after them. You're listening to Financial Survival. Oh, can you feel it? Oh, won't you tell me again tonight?
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
And one more time, you're listening to Financial Survival. Welcome back. I'm Dave Allen. Let's just finish up what we were talking about at the end of last segment about gold and its outlook. Cameron Alexander, who is director of precious metal research at Refinitiv, said with respect to their third quarter report, in the near term, we're likely to see increased volatility, choppy trading, and fluctuation in the stock markets and thus the gold price, particularly in the run-up to the elections. However, he added, looking farther down the road, the underlying macroeconomic conditions, such as economic headwinds, low interest rate environment, ongoing tensions between the U.S. and China, rising inflationary expectations, and the looming new wave of COVID remain highly favorable for gold in the medium to long term. If you're interested in adding gold or silver to your portfolio, ladies and gentlemen, please call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 375-4188, toll free. Now, our latest blog, which will be out soon after this program is over, is really about what yesterday's record GDP report doesn't say. Listeners can subscribe to our free weekly What a Rush of Gold and Silver blogs and our American Survival newsletters at dgscoins.com, or you can read them on our Facebook page at dgscoins. That's the at sign dgscoins, one word. So, if you measure growth in an economy over a period of one quarter, i.e. 3 months, some economists would have you believe the 2020 recession is over. But, as we've been saying for a few weeks now, look underneath the hood of yesterday's GDP report, and it's clear the most important part of the economy, the services sector, is still mired in a severe downturn. Services makes up two-thirds of the U.S. economy. Well, more importantly, the consumer makes up two-thirds of the U.S. economy. The service sector is comprised of what's become undesirable in the wake of the pandemic, such as eating in restaurants, having drinks in bars, and traveling. Now, on the flip side, the level of spending on stuff, things like cars, clothing, footwear, and so forth, hit the highest level on record. As Melody mentioned, the government said it was up over 40% in the third quarter. Spending on services did rise in the third quarter compared to the second, but it's still 7.2% where it was 1 year ago. Meantime, spending on goods seems to have made a full recovery. And then some. I mean, it's almost 7% higher than the same quarter a year ago. Economist Nathan Sheets at PGIM Fixed Income believes there's been some substitution away from services toward goods. He says, quote, some families canceled summer travel and instead spent the money on goods like home improvements and furnishings. The U.S. economy has plenty of ground to make up to get back to pre-pandemic levels, but a continued drag on the services sector in particular, which is already at risk of getting worse with a resurgence of the pandemic, makes a full recovery that much harder. Here's how the KPMG chief economist Constance Hunter puts it. If we don't get a handle handle in the pandemic now, services consumption is not going to rebound. And if services consumption doesn't rebound, we're not going to see employment rebound. And that's going to have spillover effects over the whole recovery. Now, with that as a backdrop, consumers are planning to pare back the most spending on vacations and travel during the upcoming holiday season. It's another possible concern for the services sector. The Conference Board estimates that overall consumer spending this holiday season is expected to be roughly in line with last year. That is, they'll spend an average of $673 on gifts in 2020, essentially the same as the $675 they were estimated to have spent in 2019. The bad news? The 2020 figure didn't go up. I mean, it's because the retail sector has been hit hard, even though some of the numbers we've been sharing make it seem like it's doing okay. In any event, retailers are hoping consumers will open up their wallets during the holiday season so companies can recoup lost revenue from the onset of the pandemic. The pandemic is expected to push reliance on e-commerce for gift shopping into overdrive. In fact, 52% said they plan to do at least half of their shopping online this year, while roughly 42% said the same in 2019. Well, let's just hope more ma and pop shops have installed and updated their e-commerce systems as the Amazons and Walmarts lick their chops as they get ready to go in for the final kill. And a look out soon after today's program for this week's edition of What a Rush of Gold and Silver Blog. Next up, the Trump White House has notified Congress of its intent to sell 50 Lockheed Martin F-35 to the United Arab Emirates. Those are strike fighter jets, in a sale that could amount to $10 billion. And this news comes less than 2 months after the signing of the Abraham Accord. That's the agreement establishing diplomatic relations between Israel and the UAE. That deal is seen as opening up a wealth of opportunities in trade, technology, and security cooperation with Israel's blessing. The UAE has for years had its eye on the F-35, which is the most advanced fighter jet platform on the market, the world market. The main hurdle was always Israel, which under U.S. policy is legally guaranteed what's called a qualitative military edge that ensures a technological advantage over its neighbors and exclusive access to some of America's best arms. So it was major news when Israel's defense minister last week said the country would not oppose Washington selling certain weapon systems to the Emiratis, widely interpreted as a green light for the F-35, which Israel, by the way, already owns. Now, unfathomable just a few weeks ago, this development speaks volumes about the Israel-UAE relations and rapidly fortifying alliances against Iran that will ultimately define the Middle East for decades to come. If approved, the sale would make the UAE only the second country in the Middle East to get this fifth-generation system. Michael Rubin, who's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, said that the Israelis have no objection, suggests that the agreement between Israel and the UAE just isn't based on mutual interest, but also on trust. Still, this is a big but, there's still no done deal yet. Congressional approvals, as well as bureaucratic ones over security concerns, export-import regulations, also ensuring that no highly classified information about the platform's capabilities can be accessed by hostile powers, all remain key hurdles. The F-35 is the Pentagon's most expensive procurement program to date and is thought to be more advanced than anything else anywhere. It's known for its ability, the F-35, to identify and eliminate threats before it's detected. Also, stealth technology, supersonic flight speeds, and highly classified passive tracking capabilities. Price tag, mere $100 million apiece. But congressional and bureaucratic approvals shouldn't be assumed as automatic. Congress has been hostile to Gulf weapons exports in recent years, in fact. And a potential new presidential administration could cause delays. Yesterday, Joe Biden's foreign policy advisor expressed concerns about what commitments may or may not have been made to the UAE with regard to the F-35. Still, an important and fascinating development. All right, now I know that I in particular, have been spending a lot of time over the past few weeks writing more, but mostly, but also talking on this program with Melody about banks, bankers, and some of the not-so-good things that they've been doing. And now raising banker compensation, particularly in the midst of a pandemic when almost 23 million Americans are still out of work, probably isn't the best look. I guess that's a given. But some observers say this is the dilemma facing Wall Street after a bumper year for their stock performance, their bottom lines. So, pay too little, you lose your stars. Pay too much, you just infuriate the public. Across investment banking, however, it's going to be a year to remember, and not just because of the work-from-home experiment. Slumping economies the world over, soaring unemployment, it prompted central banks and governments everywhere to unleash unprecedented monetary and fiscal stimulus. And with the world awash in cash, companies have been selling debt at a record pace, while market volatility has bolstered banks' revenue from trading stocks and bonds. Now, with the possible exception of an M&A slowdown, securities firms, these big banks, have been firing on all cylinders, now at least until this week. Three consecutive quarters of substantial profit leave them on the course for their best year since the Great Recession. So how and whether to reward, that's an awkward question, and it's one that people like UBS, Credit Suisse, Deutsche Bank, and all the other too big to fail banks are grappling with. Should traders really be the beneficiary of public policies designed to help struggling individuals, or of the market swings caused by a global emergency? Unfortunately, there are some who say it's hard to see how banks can avoid paying out. After all, they say investment banking is a competitive sport, and the winners want the rewards. Only regulators can really stand in their way. If one firm were to break ranks and keep a lid on compensation, others would seize the chance to lure their best moneymakers away with better pay. European banks have grown tired of seeing U.S. rivals cherry-pick their big hitters. While the Wall Street giants have been managing expectations on bonuses, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley have signaled they'll pay for performance. We've argued many times before that the days of lavish compensation may have been over, and that's certainly true for many bankers, but the pandemic has strengthened the hand of the stars. Lockdowns, working from home, have made it much harder to solicit new clients because of restricted face-to-face contact. That means established relationships are crucial, relationships that have been developed over sometimes 5, 10, and more years. And replacing staff is also tough when so many are working remotely. Firms can't solve the problem by promoting internally either, and junior bankers aren't the ones with bulging Rolodexes. Banks, however, they're going to find it tough to justify bonuses, and not just externally. Many firms' traditional banking divisions, like commercial lending, are struggling because of the distressed economy and lower interest rates. Net profit at the group level is often under pressure as provisions for bad loans eat into record trading income. Arguing that traders should get a bigger slice of the profits? That won't be easy, and it shouldn't be either in these times. And that explains why some banks are getting creative with their rewards. Switzerland's UPS, for example, has found a clever way to dodge the dreaded bonus headlines by boosting fixed salaries for its top owners retroactively from January 1st. That's pretty significant. When, you know, you're got a base pay of $200,000, $500,000, you're getting a 20% pay raise. That's $100,000 for those making five. Such approaches also circumvent the biggest impediment to boosting bonuses, regulators. Banks in the European Union are, de facto anyway, barred by the European Central Bank from paying dividends until the end of the year. And they're expected to show what the ECB has called for extreme moderation on executive pay. And even though the ECB might relax its dividend recommendations next year, it doesn't follow automatically that they're going to change their rules on compensation. Expect more banks to copy the UBS model on higher basic salaries, as well as using deferred pay and stock awards rather than cash payout. The more things change, ladies and gentlemen, the more they remain the same. That's the end of today's program. We'll call it a week and say thank you so much for tuning in. It's been a pleasure reporting to you, talking to you. We have Melody Cedarstrom and Discount Gold and Silver Trading. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll talk to you again on Monday. I'm Dave Allen. Have a good weekend. Bye-bye.